Welcome to the Solar Storm. This is your host, Kyle Hunt, right here on RenegadeBroadcasting.com. Today is June 29th, 2014. Thank you so much for being here. Summer is heating up, folks, and the news is going nuts. You can check out our new news feature over at RenegadeBroadcasting.com right there on the homepage. Also, we have, of course, the new stream with all the different streaming options, including mobile. So I want to announce also that we have mobile support now for all the different archive shows. So you can very easily go to RenegadeBroadcasting.com on your phone and listen to all the archives. We will get a true mobile version of the site at some point in the future, but a lot more to come, folks, in terms of site improvements and different things going on the network. Andy is no longer with us on Monday nights, which is a damn shame, but Andy lives in Canada where they're not allowed to question historical events. They don't have the First Amendment. They don't have the Second Amendment. And it's a tricky situation broadcasting with Renegade living in Canada. Tonight, folks, I have Mr. Attorney Don Advo. He is a co-host at Stormfront Radio. Don, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Kyle. It's a great pleasure to be on your show. We've talked before, and I couldn't be happier than to be a guest here tonight.
Fantastic. Can you tell us how things are going with Stormfront Radio and when people can catch it and where?
Yeah, things are going very well at Stormfront Radio. You can go to the Stormfront website and just click on the live listen or click on the archives. There are show summaries going back for about 6 months. And Stormfront Radio broadcasts, I think it's 6 o'clock Eastern Standard Time through 8 o'clock. It's 2 hours each day. I'm kind of an alternating co-host on the second hour. Don Black does both hours, and Roy and Paul Fromm, the famous Canadian free speech activist and immigration reformer, is also an alternate host during the second hour. He makes a great contribution.
Yeah, I've listened to quite a bit of the shows you do over there, and it's a very good radio program that you put together every single morning, at least every weekday. And it's always a fascinating kind of rotating guest hosts or co-hosts and all the rest to get all these different points of view on that program. So I do encourage people to go check that out. And the archives are freely available. Jeff Rentz doesn't have his archives freely available, but Stormfront Radio's archives, all you have to do is just do an internet search and you'll be able to access them right there. And as you said, they can just go to stormfront.org, a site that's been around and very popular for a long time now, and putting out a consistent pro-white message. So that's always good to support people that are doing that. Don, I wanted to get into a lot of different things related to your legal career. You are an attorney, and you're in California, and I have a lot of questions about the legal system that I'm hoping that you can answer, being in the field yourself. And a lot of this goes over our people's heads, even though they are living within this legal structure. So I think it's very important that we understand about the laws of the land and the laws of the sea as well, and basically use them to our advantage. Because without a proper understanding, you're putting yourself at the mercy of others who know more than you. Is that the way it kind of operates as you see it?
Yeah, that's actually quite correct. Also, you're putting yourself at the mercy of people who have far more power than you,
yes,
separate and apart from the issue of what they know or they don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the main obstacle in the legal system, is power, not knowledge.
Can you tell us as much or as little as you'd like for the audience to know about your legal career and what got you into the field, and maybe if there are any interesting cases that you could discuss with us?
Well, I'm kind of at the end of my legal career. I'm almost semi-retired. I've been practicing for more than 30 years, and none of my I'm not one of those celebrity lawyers about whom you will have heard very much. I was one of the few lawyers in California who didn't go on cable television to talk about OJ. But I've been involved in the pro-white movement for about the last 10 to 12 years. It was kind of something I got involved with very recently, kind of through a back door. I met David Irving at a gun show out here in California, and I was familiar with his books, and I was quite surprised. He books at a gun show. That's not where you ordinarily would see a best-selling author, but he was there, and we spoke briefly, and I became aware of the kind of persecution that he has endured at the hands of the real rulers of our country. And I became aware of the Institute for Historical Review, and I attended their 2000 conference out here in Southern California, and primarily the subject was World War II revisionism and the nonconformist version of World War II history. And I was stunned by the fact that half of the speakers there had been in jail, and the other half have been in jail since then, it seems like the number of speakers who have not been prosecuted and put in jail at some point in time is smaller than the other way around. That includes David Irving, Ernest Zundel, Robert Farazan, Guillermo Rudolph was also there as a speaker. And so that's how I got into the pro-white movement. It was obvious to me that our race is being targeted for disparate, discriminatory treatment. And the illegal immigration movement was another factor that pushed me in the direction of pro-white advocacy, that the state of California has been invaded and is occupied. In the mid-1990s, we tried to fight back against this occupation and this transfer of the wealth from California's working people to the illegal alien population by passing a ballot initiative called Proposition 187. That would have separated illegal aliens from the welfare trough that draws them here. It isn't the chance to work that draws them here. They can work just as hard in their own country as they can here. But what we have here that they don't have in their own country is a very, very prosperous and a very generous welfare state that starts from the minute they're born until the moment that they die. There was one particular legal matter in which I was involved that really brought home the magnitude of how thoroughly subjugated we are. I handled a criminal matter for another counsel. And it was three Mexican guys who had been convicted of breaking into cars in underground garages or apartments in Santa Monica and stealing stereos and whatever else they could get. I represented one of these guys at the preliminary hearing, and while I was sitting in master calendar in Santa Monica waiting to be assigned out in the courtroom, you know, the judges will hear other matters, most of which were probation violations and minor matters. It struck me that the only white people in the courtroom were the judge, the cops, and the professional people. All of the defendants, even those who looked nominally white, spoke in very strange accents that were very difficult to understand. And then when I met my wonderful client and read his pretrial probation report, I was stunned to find out not only was he an illegal alien, he had 6 children with 3 different women, plus a wife, and all of his children and all of the women with whom he had them were on welfare. That's 9 people on welfare.
Wow.
And after I finished that matter, I called a lawyer on whose behalf I handled that, and I told him, I said, does this kind of thing happen very often? And he was stunned that I was surprised. He said, it is more the rule than the exception. Mexicans are highly polygamous. They have children with lots of different women. The welfare system is very generous. And he told me about a Pacific Islander in Orange County who has 10 children with half a dozen different women, none of whom he supports, all of whom are supported by the taxpayers of the state of California. So the extent to which white people are being targeted for dispossession and looting, and this is not migration, this is a foreign invasion of our country. It's called immigration, but it is an invasion by people of a foreign power who come here to dispossess us, to take our land, to take our wealth, and ultimately to hunt us down and kill us. When they come into an area, that area is no longer even suitable for human habitation. The Mexicans come in, you've got 4 or 5 families living in each house. You've got, your public resources go bankrupt. We've had, a huge number of hospitals here in the metropolitan Los Angeles area go bankrupt because they can't say no to illegal aliens. They are required to treat them by law, and when the money runs out, the hospitals go bankrupt. But one of our Mexican county supervisors used $18 million of taxpayer money to build a Mexican cultural center, so we're losing hospitals, but we're gaining Mexican cultural centers. Isn't that nice?
Oh, yeah, it's wonderful. It's enrichment, as they call it. Now, how are we supposed to deal with this when it's the lawmakers themselves who are saying, come one, come all, and passing laws that ensure that these people are given primo treatment? They're the ones giving the green light, encouraging all of these children to be flooding over the border right now, these dreamers who will become American citizens if these lawmakers have their way. You have Nancy Pelosi down there on the border saying, we're all Americans. It doesn't matter if you're from South America, Central America. These borders separating these countries and these peoples, they're meaningless. So come on in. We'll take care of you. She said it's just a shame that she couldn't have them all come live with her. But, she'll maybe employ some of them as her gardeners, let's say. I don't know.
At minimum wage, no doubt.
Right. Yeah. No, so they could be free interns for her, perhaps. It's incredible. You have an amnesty activists, some of them, I guess, illegal, storming the Congress the other day. How is it that an illegal alien power is able to invade these sacred halls of Congress? It's because they're letting them in. Amnesty activists wouldn't be able to get anywhere near Congress unless they were given the green light to come on in. It's all a complete that's a complete circus that's going
on
right now.
They are able to be present in the halls of Congress, and we are not, because they occupy a superior legal status, and we occupy a subordinate legal status, not only as Americans, but most especially as white Americans. One of the great historical riddles and one of the great political ironies is the fact that the leadership of black people in this country and the black community has been devastated by the illegal alien invasion even to a greater extent than the white community. One of the great puzzles is why the black leadership has aligned the black community with the illegal alien invasion that is so hostile to blacks. Mexicans hate blacks. They openly call them niggers. There are places here in metropolitan Southern California that have been taken over by Mexicans where black people cannot go without the fear of being shot on sight. You hear this from rank-and-file black people. You read about it in the newspapers. There have been 2 federal hate crime prosecutions actually publicized in the news media wherein black people were shot by Mexican gangbangers, and they were shot for the express purpose of terrorizing black people and driving them out of the community.
Well, I've read all about how there are race riots at these different high schools in Los Angeles. I've even heard that Compton, the historically black ghetto in Los Angeles, is now pretty much Mexican, taken over by Mexican gangs.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
So
they now make up the majority in that city.
Yeah, it's very strange to me that a lot of these blacks, especially in places that aren't right up there on the border, are supporting the Democratic candidates who are for amnesty. They somehow seem to think that if they're able to team up with other minority groups against the white man, that they'll actually be better off, when this is absolute insanity, considering how well the white man has actually treated them in the larger scope of things, and how poorly conditions would be under Mexican rule in these cities, and black rule, such as has happened in Detroit, and in other formerly beautiful cities that have become wastelands because of these policies, which are inherently anti-white, which are for the ethnic cleansing of white people from any major metropolitan area, pretty much.
Well, from any area whatsoever, they want
yeah,
us exterminated, and they want us dead, and they somehow have this weird utopian idea that a world without white people is going to be some kind of utopia, and the welfare checks are going to continue to flow, and the electricity will continue, and the toilets will continue to flush. And I suggest that the experiences of Detroit and Oakland and other minority-controlled cities show that just the opposite is true.
Now, when you were practicing out in California, did you take any cases of people who are pro-white and have been persecuted for being pro-white? And perhaps they actually did go and commit some act of violence. I know that skinheads are somewhat more common in California than in other parts of the country. Have you dealt with very racially charged cases over your years?
No. I've never been involved in anything like that. I've never really done much criminal law at all. Only kind of nibbled at it around the edges. Mostly what I did was civil litigation, civil law, things like that. I was heavily involved in the anti-immigration movement for a while, and I was on the edges of some legal issues in that. And I can tell you that the police out here are not the friend of the white person or the friend of the American citizen. The police out here will frame white people, white activists, off for hate crimes and various other kinds of things in order to get them in jail if they possibly can. I don't know what it's like in other parts of the country, and I've gotten in trouble with some other white people from other parts of the country for being so hostile toward the police. But out here, the police are not our friends at all. I've been threatened by police. I've had my own issues with police for standing on a street corner on a sidewalk holding an American flag. I mean, that's all it takes to incur the ire of these people. I was involved in a number of very high-profile encounters between American nationalists and these Mexican communist gangs, and we were physically attacked. What they do is they'll take cans of soda pop and freeze them in the refrigerator so that they're frozen solid like bricks, and then they show up with knapsacks full of them, and they throw them at you from across the street or whatever at rallies, and that way if they get stopped, all they've got is a knapsack full of soda pop, you know, which is not perceived as a deadly weapon. But the violence out here got pretty hairy. And I don't do much that kind of street activism anymore for that reason. I mean, it's just, you know, you go out there and you get killed or you get arrested, and what's the point of it? But I do different types of activism now, obviously.
It seems like the anti-fascists have all of the big legal groups there supporting them if they get in trouble. And the police themselves often seem to be friendly with the anti-fascists for some reason, when the anti-fascists consider the police to be pigs, fascists, you know, part of the authoritarian white male regime.
My only explanation for it is that these people are in uniform and they follow the orders of the people who sign their paychecks and write their pension checks and provide their health care. And that's pretty much all the police care about. I hate to come down against the police because I've been really pro-law enforcement my entire life. But the police are going to blow with the political winds. It's just that simple. They're not going to be on our side. but we still have sufficient numbers that I think we can resist. You ask, you know, how are we to deal with this? And the answer is, it's not going to be very easy. White people, first of all, are going to have to make up their minds about whether or not they want to survive. There's no question but what we can turn this around, and there's no question but what we can prevail. The problem you deal with is in the first instance, white indifference to the outcome of this whole thing. There seems to be a kind of a defeatist attitude, like, well, if it happens, I'll be dead by then, and I don't much care. And then there is outright white hostility. There is a pathology of white self-hatred that goes back at least as early as the early 1800s in the abolitionist movement. That's still a very powerful factor and a very powerful obstacle to overcome. I think what we're mainly going to have to do is rally our own people in the manner that you have done, and the manner that Don Black has done with Stormfront, because more and more of our people are coming around. They really are. I've noticed it in the last 5 years. You see it in various kinds of ways. All the white people I know are pretty much aware of my views, and I have not lost any friends because of those views. More and more white people are coming down on my side, and even lawyers. You'll be sitting behind closed doors. And it's amazing how white people have become so conditioned to the forces of political correctness that I'll be sitting in an office with a white lawyer or a white real estate professional or an accountant, and they will actually look around furtively and lower their voice to express their honest opinion. That is how intimidated and how cowed white people have become. But at least they're speaking even in whispers, and that is a measure of progress. And I think the awakening will occur at an even greater rate, and that as the oppression grows, I think this children floating over the border has been a real shock to the system of many white people, even colorblind conservatives who are always talking about the strength of your character instead of the color of your skin. I think there has been an awakening on the part of a lot of those people. And I think the rank and file white masses are going to start dragging white leadership in our direction, whether they want to go that way or not. That's our challenge, is to awaken as many of our rank and file white brothers and sisters as we can in the time that we have left.
I think that now that white people have become so disenfranchised and the depression has really hit home for many people, they're starting to question why we have programs such as affirmative action at schools and in the workforce, and definitely in any kind of government employment opportunity. And this is legal racism against white people. Do you care to elaborate on that and also highlight some other examples of how there is an explicit anti-white bias against white people that has been codified into the legal system of this country and essentially amounts to white genocide?
Wow, that's a tall order, but I'm happy to do it. You have to – how has anti-white bias been codified into the legal system? Well, that's a long story. It has its roots in the Civil War. One of the things that has so confused our people, at least during my lifetime, and I would say in the last half century, is this kind of Orwellian practice of calling everything by a name other than what it really is. I had a girlfriend when I was in college who was a little unclear on the concept of the need to go appear on your traffic tickets, and she got picked up on a warrant, and I got a call at about 1 o'clock in the morning one night, and she said quite hysterically that I needed to come bail her out of jail, and I said, fine, where are you? And she said, I'm at the Civil Brand Institute for Women. I said, what the hell is that? I thought she said you were in jail. Well, the women's jail in California at that time, and I think still is, called the Civil Brand Institute for Women. Okay, what is an institute? It's some place where they, you know, they teach people how to play the piano, or they teach art, or they research cancer cures. It's not a jail where they take criminals. So it seemed very strange to me at the time, several decades ago. But as we go further in life, you see these things like courthouses are now called justice centers, and schools are called learning centers, and oppressive laws that are designed to relegate some people to a lower level of citizenship are called civil rights laws.
Now, that's called equality. When white people are put at the absolute, you know, last part of the line, they're put at the back of the bus, as it were. That's called equality now.
Well, you see something about the old slavery. As bad as it might have been, at least it was called slavery. And when black people ran away from it, they were called runaway slaves or fugitive slaves. It was called a fugitive slave problem. It wasn't called, they weren't called, you know, it wasn't called black flight. And when they submitted fugitive slave laws to Congress, they were called fugitive slave laws. They were not called civil rights laws. Well, the function of civil rights laws enacted in this country since, most notoriously since the 1960s, is to strip white people of their rights of freedom of association and their rights of freedom of contact. The purpose of these laws, but rather to vest non-white people with the legal ability to force unwilling white people into various kinds of contractual relationships and various other kinds of associations. Before these laws were enacted, no person, whether white or black, could force an unwilling person into a contract. But in the aftermath of these civil rights laws, every minority here in the world, every sexual deviant can force a white person, a white business person, a white property owner, a white apartment landlord to rent to someone in violation of the white person's right of traditional right of freedom of contract. And that's one aspect of what I call the new slavery. Under the old slavery, which was actually called slavery, black people were stripped of their rights of freedom of association and their rights of freedom of contract. Under the new slavery, euphemistically called the civil rights movement, it is white people who are stripped of their rights of freedom of association. And it goes not only to the extent of stripping whites of their rights of freedom of contract, but to even creating a possessory interest, a legal possessory interest in the persons of white children. The famous Brown versus the Board of Education decision decided by our Supreme Court in 1954 invented a new constitutional right completely out of thin air. It gave black people the constitutional right to force a captive white child to sit in a classroom next to them. At, you know, 85 years after the Civil War ended, it vested black people with property rights in white children. And naturally, the impulse of white people was to run away from this kind of oppression, as black people ran away from oppression in the years before the Civil War. Only they weren't called fugitive white people, it was called white flight. And the system reacted by various kinds of laws to cast a net over a wider geographical area as white people fled so that white children could be captured and bused in and forced into these racially integrated schools. So white children have been officially relegated to the level of property, to the level of livestock under the new caste system, which calls itself social justice and racial equality. And that's one of the most important things that we have to challenge if we're ever going to achieve white emancipation. We have to challenge the holding in Brown versus the Board of Education, which created property rights in white children. And we have the rights clause, which stripped white people of their rights of free association and freedom of contract. Because remember, it's not just that it stripped us of our rights of refusal of doing business with people we don't particularly want to do business with. It stripped us of the ability to have white organizations. It stripped us of the ability to organize, to advance our own interests, to advocate our own interests, and to compete politically, economically, and demographically with every other racial group in the country. What has been established is a racial spoil system in this country today. And every other race, every other ethnic group has its own organizations. The Jews have the ADL and the World Jewish Congress and a plethora of organizations. The blacks have the NAACP, the Urban League, and all their groups. The Hispanics have La Raza, they have Mecha, they have the Hispanic Caucus. College admissions, jobs, and every other aspect of society is being dispersed in accordance with a racial spoil system, and every other race is organized to compete in that system except white people. Because the civil rights laws have stripped us of our rights to organize and to associate, white people alone are forced to compete against other organized races in our capacity as isolated, disorganized, independent white individuals. And we are getting wiped out for that reason. There is no white caucus. There is no white civil rights organization. There is no organization that is going to spring into action when innocent white children are the victims of racially motivated violence and racially motivated discriminatory treatment in public schools. Just to give you one very, very important example, white children have been abandoned and cast adrift to fend for themselves. You know, if our military, if 18-year-olds were drafted and sent abroad into a war zone without weapons, without equipment, without logistical support, it would be a scandal. There would be people marching in the streets. But every day in this country, white children from the ages of 5 and 6 on up to into their 20s are sent into these racially integrated schools with savages and stripped of any right of self-defense and stripped of any racial protection because all of the school administrations and the governments are beholden to these non-white political groups. It's that simple.
Don, you have something of a solution that you crafted. It's called the ADVO Amendment. Maybe it's a good time to get into that. If you wouldn't mind reading it even, that would be great so the audience can understand what you think would be a good way to legally solve this problem, at least a good start.
Well, I think it would be a good start. It's been called the ADVO Amendment. I like the idea of calling it the 28th Amendment because it's a little we have 27. If we have 28 amendments, that is the number it would come in. The purpose of my proposed 28th Amendment would be to reinstate the right of freedom of association and freedom of contract for white people. The effect of this amendment, if it were enacted, would be to wipe out 90% of all civil rights laws. It would wipe out the Civil Rights Act of 64 and every other civil rights act, whether at the federal, state, or municipal level, that destroys the right of people to contract with whomever they choose to contract. Let me just read the text of the amendment as it presently stands, and I think it will be clear to your listeners what the purpose of this amendment is and how it would work. Quote, "The right of freedom of association, however and by whomever exercised on the basis of religion, race, color, ethnicity, national origin, age, gender, sexual orientation, or physical or mental disability, whether real or perceived, whether exercised individually or otherwise, whether exercised to make and enforce contracts or otherwise, whether exercised in commerce or otherwise, by individuals over the age of 18, is absolute and shall not be regulated or abridged by the United States, several states, or any political subdivision thereof." End quote. That is the text of the proposed 28th Amendment.
And there's pretty much no way that that could get passed with our current legislator.
State constitutional amendments are ratified by a vote of 3/4 of the states, and I think it would be a pretty daunting task to get that ratified. Obviously, the Congress would never do it. But there's something very interesting about this amendment. You'll notice that it's racially neutral. And I have shown this amendment to a number of people, and interestingly enough, people have said to me, "Gee, I didn't think you were so liberal that you would propose something like that." Even liberal people who read it don't understand what the legal effect would be.
It
sounds like liberal feel-goodism.
Like non-discrimination. Like you shouldn't discriminate against people who want to be proud of themselves. They don't understand that white people currently don't have that right.
Well, they certainly don't understand that if this thing were made part of the Constitution, it would wipe out the Civil Rights Act of 64 and just about every other Civil Rights Act on the books. And I got the idea for this. I was kind of formulating in my mind a battle plan to achieve white emancipation, and part of that consisted of a repeal of the Civil Rights Act of 64, a repeal of Brown versus the Board of Education, and a repeal of the Martin Luther King holiday, because these are all very, very important steps in our subjugation. But the whole civil rights thing is such a daunting labyrinth. There are thousands of laws at every level, federal, state, and municipal. Mm-hmm. And I thought, why not just draft a constitutional amendment that would wipe them all out in one stroke? And so this is what I came up with. And it's more of an intellectual exercise than anything. I don't have any money to try to get it started, and no one has expressed any interest in it. But I think it is a fascinating intellectual exercise, and I think it helps our people focus on the relationship of the right of freedom of association and with slavery and with the new civil rights regime. And if you have to understand that the civil rights regime as it currently exists and the old institution of slavery are simply two sides of the same coin, they have the same moral premise, and that moral premise is a violation of the right of freedom of association and also the right of freedom of contract.
Right. You can't have freedom if you don't have freedom of association. So
absolutely right.
Ergo, you're a slave. If you don't have freedom, you're probably a slave. And so that's really what has happened, is that these shackles of today are not made of iron, made of steel. They are mental and legal, primarily. And, of course, these can turn into physical shackles if you speak up a little too much, as we had already touched upon before in mentioning Ernst Zundel and others who have spent a lot of time behind bars for just trying to tell the truth, seeking justice for historical wrongs. So it is a very daunting task we are faced with when we are being enslaved, forcibly integrated, at the tip of a bayonet, at the point of a gun. This is what had happened in Dixie. So what happened in Boston when these civil rights laws were first passed. But I think one of the big problems was that the middle-class white people didn't really get too badly affected initially. Their jobs weren't being replaced through this economic apartheid of affirmative action, where jobs are given to black people over more talented white people, and their schools weren't being completely overrun. So they kind of just decided, hey, I don't want to speak up too much, even if I agree with those people who are a little bit less fortunate than myself who have to be in these terrible environments. I'm not going to speak up too much because, you know, you stick your head out too much, it'll get chopped off. And so they kind of just sold their folks down the river. They didn't really care too much. Some of them bought into the programming entirely because they weren't living around the blacks or the Mexicans or whoever else, the Asians. They didn't understand the realities. They bought into the TV programming, and they condemned their fellow white people in the South and elsewhere just as being racist. And that's what we have today, is a very strong divide between people who understand the reality of the situation, perhaps from living in it firsthand, and those who are off in some la-la land being programmed from Hollywood out there in L.A. It's really a sharp divide. I think the lines are being drawn right now, and people are sorting themselves out. And a lot of white people are starting to get some sense. And as you mentioned, I think that this illegal invasion has really woken them up. They're seeing that these other groups of people can completely break the law and get rewarded for it. While if they were to try the same thing, going to Mexico or just, you know, break the law in America, they would be severely punished. So they see the double standard. And a lot of people are just wondering, why are these people considered so much more valuable than me that we have to subsidize everything for them? We've got to roll out the red carpet to make sure that they flood in here in as large of numbers as possible. And so this is a very, I think, defining moment for our people. And I am optimistic. I'd like to get your take on whether or not this optimism is founded, and also what we can do with all of this awakening energy in order to have productive, lasting changes. You already mentioned the ADVO Amendment, the 28th Amendment. What other steps do we need along the way to really regaining control of our destiny, throwing off the shackles that have been bound on us, and gaining freedom?
What other steps? Well, We need people like you. We need people like me, and who to speak out and give our people courage by our example. And we need to give our people some intellectual and moral clarity. have to, this Orwellian practice of calling everything by its opposite name, it's interesting that under the old slavery, which has been called genocidal and a Holocaust and all these charged terms, the black population exploded. In 1790, there were about 600,000 black slaves in the 13 colonies, and by the time of the Civil War, that number had exploded to approximately 4.5 million. There were 400,000 free blacks in the United States, half of whom lived in the South. Now, isn't it interesting that under the new civil rights regime, the white population, the population of people who are targeted for dispossession and looting, our population is dwindling and shrinking almost every year. So people, I think, instinctively understand something is very, very wrong, because every time a new civil rights law is passed or some new group is vested with civil rights that are kind of created out of thin air, the rest of us have fewer rights, and every time we embark upon some new war to make the world safer democracy, it seems like there's less democracy in our own country. We routinely see the courts in this country veto and set aside election results that they don't like. That's what happened here in California with Proposition 187. 60% of the California electorate at that time voted to cut off the welfare trough and deny it to access to illegal aliens, and the federal court said that you can't defend yourself. They have more rights than you have. And now we see these courts all over the country nullifying state elections that deal with the gay rights issue. Amazingly enough, the right to come to this country illegally and the right to kill unborn children and the right of gays to get married, although they do not exist anywhere in the Constitution or any of the Bill of Rights, these rights are far more secure than traditional rights such as freedom of speech and freedom of religion. And people have to achieve clarity. They have to understand what's really going on, or they will never be able meaningfully to address it. And what we have to do meaningfully to address the problem of whites being targeted for extermination is to make white people aware of that fact, to make them aware that we live in a racial spoil system, and if we are not organized and prepared to fight for our interest in that system, we will simply be pushed aside and exterminated. We will not be able, you cannot start a family if you don't have the ability to support your own children and support and financially support a family. And that's one of the reasons the white birth rate is shrinking as it is. Whites are forced to limit the number of children they have to the number of children they can privately educate or homeschool or sustain. Other racial groups don't care about supporting their children. They look to the white taxpayer to support their children with various kinds of welfare. We all know this. It's obvious everywhere. Well, these people don't seem to understand that when the white worker who supports all this disappears, the welfare state will disappear, at least in its present condition. It won't have the ability. White people have a unique ability to support large numbers of parasites. But when the white host perishes, the parasites will be relegated back to the level, to the standard of living they had before they came here, before they just made to understand that. They have got to be able to made to believe that white people have a right to exist. We have a right to exist. We have a right to organize. We have a right to start families. We have a right to the product of our own labor. And we have a right to our own country. Without a sense of white self-consciousness, we're not going to get very far. But I think we are making progress in that direction.
Well, what I see to be a problem is that a lot of our people want to be law-abiding citizens, but when the law of this country encourages white genocide and forces white genocide, then it's you become something of an outlaw. Now, I actually wanted to touch upon this aspect of us just being becoming such easy prey within this legal system, because from what I understand, because there are so many laws on the books, many people are breaking many laws throughout the day. Each and every day, people unknowingly will break laws, sometimes serious ones. They'll things that could be felonies, and they don't know it because the laws are so extensive. We have books upon books updated copies of these very hard to understand, hard to read legal definitions, different case law that you have to look into, and it's not accessible to the average person out there. So really, you know, I feel like this whole legal system needs to be completely simplified. Basically, what has to happen to the government in terms of getting rid of so many of these useless, and actually not just useless, harmful bureaucracies, and replace it with something efficient, I think this needs to happen to the legal system as well. Because as it currently stands, they've made it such that it's so confusing, it's so obese, that it's almost impossible to get wrap your mind around it. And this just enables this system to persecute us simply because we have a lack of knowledge, when, in fact, most lawyers and judges out there probably cannot know the entirety of the law whatsoever. That's why I have to reference their law books. That's why I have to do a bunch of research for a case. What are your thoughts on this? Why has this legal system become so convoluted, so massive, and how can it be either more easily understood by people or be reformed?
Well, legal system in California is the least generously funded of the three branches of government. Here in Los Angeles County, they've shut down 25% of the courtrooms at the state level because they don't have enough funding. The problem is the laws are made not the court. The laws are not made by the judicial system, but by the legislature. And the reason we have so many laws is that we have, a lot of special interest groups that are clamoring for laws. There's a big push by the Obama administration now to govern through regulations rather than by legislation. So he's usurped legislative power himself. There's not much you can do about that if you have a Congress that will not impeach him or will not stand up to him in any meaningful sense. You're quite correct that the law is very difficult for the average person to understand. I don't know how that is in part a result of the growing complexity of society, the growing population density. You have to regulate more because you have more people, I suppose. But the real attack on us, the real attack on white people, comes through these various civil rights laws and the environmental laws. This whole global warming scam is simply a backdoor attack on our economy. Obviously, the free trade regimen, whereby all of our factories are shipped overseas, is another attack on us, because if you shrink the physical economy, you shrink the ability of that economy to support its people. And then when you overload it with, 20 million people from outside the country, it's really going to be stretched to the breaking point. You have this kind of Orwellian, Hobbesian, dog-eat-dog competition for what's left of our economy. And it's not so much the legal system as it is the courts are really the least powerful, even though when they do wield power, they have the ability to overturn elections and create new rights and do these things. But in terms of, the day-to-day operation of the legal system, it's very much outside all of that. Obviously, there's too many laws and they're too complicated. And one of the ways you can do something about that is to have a society where people are more characterized by an ability to govern themselves and regulate themselves. These minorities, they come from countries that really don't have much character. Don't have much quality for self-control and self-regulation. So if you have an all-white country or an all-white segment of a country, there's really less of a need for regulation. One thing I've noticed is you drive through minority neighborhoods or black neighborhoods near downtown Los Angeles, every single house has bars on the doors and windows. I've never seen a white neighborhood where every single house had bars on the doors and windows. White people trust each other more. They behave better toward each other. And when you see the transformation from a white neighborhood to a brown or a black neighborhood, that's one of the things that you see. Is you see, you know, cyclone fencing around the property line, and you see bars on all the doors and windows because of the way they behave toward each other. Toward each other.
It becomes a war zone. It's a war
zone. Well, it does, and it's not white people who are going into black neighborhoods and shooting black children and robbing black people. It's Mexicans and other black criminals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we're not the problem.
I've lived in white neighborhoods, and it's amazing how safe and comfortable you can feel. You leave your front door unlocked. That's just standard practice, because if somebody wants to come up to talk to you, come into your house, they're going to knock first. They won't even try to open the door without being let in. This is just the way that white people have been functioning for so long. This is, it could be called common courtesy and also perhaps common law. I'd like to get into perhaps the differences between maritime law and common law as you understand it, as this has become something of a relevant issue to some people over the past few years on their quest for truth. There are people that are talking about common law versus maritime law. Do you understand where I'm coming from with this, with the different people? Jordan Maxwell, I think he's actually out there in L.A., has been talking about this for some time. I'm not saying he's not a a very distinct difference between how people interact with common law as opposed to maritime law. And maritime law pretty much treats people as corporations or even corpses, non-living entities. Is this a correct understanding of the issue?
I don't know much about maritime law other than it deals with the issues of, navigable waters. I had one case that was a personal injury case where it happened on Lake Mead, which is a navigable waterway, so maritime law impacted there. But that really has to do with the obligations of sea captains and, you know, relationships among various ships. It's kind of like the vehicle code of the ocean. I don't know. Other than that, I don't know anything about maritime law.
Okay, so that's a good, interesting response, because what some people are arguing is that maritime law is actually what is being enforced in the majority of cases that crimes are taking place here on land, but basically are being treated as though they were happening on sea, because basically the captains of these pirate ships have extended their dominion over the land as well.
I never heard of that.
Yeah, basically they say that if you see a gold-fringed American flag in a courtroom, that's an indication that's maritime law rather than common law. It's something that is probably there to mislead people in this quest for truth and getting them looking down, different alleys instead of getting out there and actually doing something productive about the situation, really coming to some proper conclusions as to the nature of the system that has enslaved us.
I've heard some lore about the gold fringed flag, and that's supposed to be some secret symbol or something, but I really don't know much about it beyond that. I don't think that's a very productive line of inquiry.
Well, I shouldn't have even brought it up then.
You can bring up anything you have a question about. I'm just saying I've never seen a case decided on the basis of the gold fringed flag. There are a lot of charlatans in this movement. There are a lot of people who peddle a lot of folklore, and much of which I think these people make up themselves, so they can create a constituency or people to sell books to or talk to or whatever. But you can read. I mean, we talked about Brown versus the Board of Education and white flight and subjects such as that. I mean, you can read the Supreme Court decisions yourself and decide whether, you know, what is the basis of it, whether there in fact is any basis to it at all. And I don't think I've never seen any reference in any of these laws to maritime law. Maritime law is kind of a specialized area of law, and it really doesn't have much to do with the civil rights regimen or affirmative action or any of these other things. And the treating of corporations as individuals and as people, that's that's a subject of great confusion among some of our people. Corporations are simply voluntary associations among consenting individuals, in much the same way as a church is a voluntary association. They're a partnership, and there's nothing particularly evil or sinister about corporations. They serve a very useful purpose, a very useful function, and they're treated as people for certain reasons, for purposes of due process and notice and an opportunity to be heard. They have the ability to exercise certain constitutional rights, like freedom of the press and freedom of speech, and freedom to engage in business activities. You can't just, go into a corporation's business premises and take all their property in violation of the law just because it's a group of individuals rather than a single individual. And that's all a corporation is. It's simply an entity that exists separate and apart from the individuals that make it up.
All right. Well, Don, what I'd like to do is go to a quick break here.
Sure.
And then we'll come back, and I wanted to get your take on a number of issues regarding the history of our legal system, why it's important to have laws and law enforcement, and a whole lot of other topics that will be related to basically the anti-white system that's been put up against us, and also perhaps how we can reform it and see some real justice. So I'm going to go to a song here by a band named Liebach, and this track is titled Whistleblowers. So, or The Whistleblowers. So we'll be back in about 4 minutes. I'll talk to you soon, Don.
Thank you.
welcome back to the Solar Storm right here on RenegadeBroadcasting.com. My guest tonight is attorney Don Advo, and we're discussing a whole lot of issues, but mostly it's focused around the legal system, at least out here in the United States. Don, this might seem like an obvious question or a simple question, but why are laws and law enforcement important, or are they, in your opinion?
Well, I think any time you have society, you have groups of people living together, there have to be certain commonly shared assumptions, and those commonly shared assumptions exist informally at the family level, but when you have many millions of people living together, there have to be rules, and people have to know the rules, and there has to be some kind of enforcement procedure. I mean, most of it's pretty basic, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, but if you're going to have modern advanced society, you have to have some sets of rules. I mean, who gets to drive on the right side of the street? You know, who has the right of way? Who owns property? If you're sitting in your house, who has the right to exclude people from your house? You or your in-law who came for Thanksgiving dinner and decides he doesn't want to leave, you know?
The government, politicians. basically what I'm getting at, being a bit sarcastic there, is that we're in a system where there are two sets of laws. It's kind of like the Talmud, where basically there are laws for one group and then there are laws for the goyim, the cattle out there. And the chosen ones aren't expected to follow the laws that are made for the goyim. Well, we've got politicians and other oligarchs and whoever else is at the elite levels of this society who don't have to follow the same laws as the rest of us, and also protected classes like minorities now who don't get punished for breaking these laws. It's just pretty much the white people who are expected to really bow down and worship at the altar of this legal system where everybody else is flagrantly breaking the laws. Barack Obama, he doesn't care about the laws. He's not there as the in the executive office to make sure that these laws are followed. I mean, that's his real purpose, but that's not what Barack Obama is doing there. He's breaking the laws. He's basically, not just him, but much of this government has been completely hijacked and is working against our own interests as Americans, not just as white Americans, but as in Americans, Americans in a larger sense right now because of what's going on with immigration and the economy in general with the different bailouts and giving trillions to international banks. It's a system where they're using laws to punish us and benefit them. So kind of the question is, why should we have to follow these laws made by politicians who flagrantly break these laws?
Well, I guess the short answer is they have the power to punish us, and we don't have the power to punish them.
That's
the short answer.
That is it. It's the same question, same answer for why should we not disobey laws that infringe upon the Bill of Rights? Why should we not disobey laws that lead to our genocide? It's because they have force right now that outweighs ours, that's for sure.
Well, I had to deal with this in a very personal way during the Clinton years when Clinton was being impeached and the whole issue of his perjury came up, and you would see Democrat lawyers and liberal lawyers go on these cable shows and talk about how, well, it's no big deal to lie in a civil case because everybody does it. And in point of fact, everybody doesn't do it, and the only people who really can skate away with such impunity are very powerful and rich people like the Clintons. It doesn't matter what they do. But myself and other lawyers I knew who had to deal with clients, you know, the clients would pressure you. They would say, well, look, you know, this guy got away with it. Nothing's happening to him. Let me take a chance in my family law case, in my divorce case, to lie and conceal assets. I mean, if I get away with it, I'm home free. If they catch me, nothing happens. And I said, you would have to say to people, look, you're not Bill Clinton. You know, if you get caught, you're going to face consequences and repercussions. And it's not an answer to our everyday situation that the wealthy and the powerful get away with committing a lot of wrongdoing that for which we would be held very strictly accountable. I don't know how to deal with the problems of their rank has its privileges. Being a powerful elite person has its privileges in any society you would ever care to show in civilization. Under the monarchies, the old monarchies against which we rebelled, I mean, if you were part of the king's retinue, you had privileges that the common people didn't have. We live under a constitution now, at least in theory, and it all gets back to anything. If white people are going to challenge this regime, they're going to have to organize and act as an organized body rather than simply as isolated individuals.
Mm-hmm. I just don't think that we need to take it to the street level in the way that some people out there seem to want to do. What the skinhead groups had historically done, where they're out there on the streets warring with Mexican gangs. I think that is definitely the wrong approach, especially because within the current legal system, if you're a pro-white and you're defending yourself and you cause a little boo-boo on somebody else, that's a hate crime. But if people attack you for being white or pro-white, it's rarely ever a hate crime. So we're in a very precarious position when we go out in the street and advocate for our race, because self-defense becomes a hate crime, oftentimes, it seems.
Well, everything you said is absolutely correct. I'm familiar with a number of instances here in Southern California where when white people were attacked at rallies, even when they did not try to defend themselves, they were charged with provoking the incident in which they themselves were the victim of physical aggression. So we are judged by a different standard. The important thing is that in terms of rank and file activism, the Antifa people and the communists cannot be everywhere. They're actually spread very, very thin, and they only seem to show up in large numbers when there is an event, a large event that is planned well in advance, and they have advanced knowledge of it. But when you did the White Man March thing, I mean, you had a lot of seemingly spontaneous rallies by people all over the country where people just showed up on a certain street corner with a banner all over the country, and it didn't take a huge, extraordinary number of them. But it took enough people that it got publicity, and it did in fact get publicity. And if, as I have pointed out before, if you Google White Man March or you Google White Genocide and click on images on your Google toolbar, you're going to get pages and pages and pages of people engaged in positive, uplifting white activism.
Well, Don,
that was a great achievement.
We have the First Amendment. Americans know about it. And
yes,
they do not like that amendment being infringed, and if they're smart Americans, it doesn't even matter if they agree with the message or not. They just don't like to see free speech being sectioned off, put in a free speech cage, or as they call them, free speech zones. Americans don't like that. They take at least the first two amendments very, very seriously, and I think that's a good sign, but they're moving aggressively with this whole no hate campaign. That sure, free speech is one thing, but when we're out to stop hate speech.
Yeah, hate speech is speech that liberals hate to hear.
Yeah,
and that's really all that involves. The main problem is that more white people have got to be willing to make up a banner, say a 10-foot banner that says diversity equals white genocide. It's got to be professionally done, and it's got to be large enough that passing by cars can read it. And stand at a busy intersection and stand on a busy street. You get 1,000 groups of 3 or 4 people each willing to do that all over the country on the same day, and it will have an impact. It really will have an impact. And the free speech zone thing is not really that big a deal. The big deal is that so many white people have been so badly battered by the psychological warfare that has been waged against us that they really don't know which way to go. They want to do something. You can hear the frustration in their voices. I listen to a lot of regular talk radio. I have it on in the background when I'm driving or sometimes when I'm sitting in my office. And you can hear the frustration in people's voices. I think they're being very badly led and very badly advised by these, kosher conservative talk radio people. But our people are there ready and waiting to be led. And I think the opposition is very much afraid of that. I think they're very much afraid that there is a spark that is going to light the powder keg of white anger, and the desire for white retribution. And it is coming. It is coming. Our people are not going to sit back and go quietly into oblivion.
Don't you think that they're provoking this formerly sleeping giant? This giant's waking up. Why are they provoking it so much right now? Do they want an overreaction, perhaps?
I think they're drunk with power. I think they're going to overreach. I think out here in California, for example, the minorities have achieved a legislative majority in the state legislature, and they're shoving all manner of laws down the throats of what is left of California's white population. But I think it's just overreaching and overconfidence. I believe that even though our numbers are dwindling relative to the majority, there are still enough of us left. Look, Cortez landed on the Mexican coast in 1518 with 187 men and 12 horses, and less than 2 years later, he had overcome the teeming millions of the Aztec Empire. Now, it's a long, complicated story how he did it, and he did so in no substantial part by creating alliances with various Indian tribes that had been enslaved and subjugated by the Aztecs, but it can be done. Our people have fought against more overwhelming odds than what we're up against now.
Oh, yeah, that's just one example.
Look, if we could go to the moon and back, we can deal with Mexicans and blacks. These people are challenged by indoor plumbing. You know, they're not that hard to take care of. They can be brushed aside.
Yeah, that's why it is the white anti-whites who really form one of the biggest obstacles we must overcome.
Well, you're right. It's our own leadership that's done this to us, acting in conjunction with an alien elite that hates us and wants us destroyed and has historic grievances against us. But also there's a measure of white indifference. I think there's going to be a significant culling of the white population of people who have become lazy and indifferent, and I think we're going to be stronger when we don't have the deadwood to carry with us any longer.
Yes, there is definitely eugenics going on right now. I see it with all these poor examples of white stock who are off miscegenating with any non-white they can find. I think it's great that, you know, their line is no longer going to be white ever again. That's fine. We'll take what we have, the strong elements, and we'll create a much stronger future through their voluntary eugenic practices. Don, we have a caller here on the line. So let's go to this for just a bit and see if they're serious and have a question. And then after
yes,
come back.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yes, hello. Who is this?
Kyle, this is William from Brooklyn. That's in Knoxville, Tennessee. And I want to talk about everything that you've been talking about. I've been listening.
All right, well, you can't because we have a guest on the air. Okay, that caller is definitely not in a position to be taking up the show right now. He has a lot he wants to say, but I'll tell you what, we don't have a whole lot of time left, and he wasn't getting to the point. People, 347-633-9657. Again, 347-633-9657. Please call in and bring your A game and come with a question or a good comment. Now, Don, that might have been a little harsh, but I am something of a fascist around here, and I don't tolerate a lot. Now, I wanted to get to talk about the basis of the legal traditions here in the West, because I think that there's a great misunderstanding of just where our laws came from, the good laws, the ones that have really helped people throughout the ages that protect us now. From what I could understand, most of our positive legal traditions come to us in the United States from the British. And actually, the British spread these legal systems throughout the world through their colonialism. And it wasn't just the British, but they took their inspiration from common law derived from the pagan Romans and Saxons, as much as I can understand. But what I'm seeing especially recently, but this is something that's been going on for decades. I'm seeing that people are trying to associate our legal system with Judeo-Christian principles and make it seem like our laws come from the Torah or the Bible, right? But from all I can tell, this is a gross misunderstanding of the reality of the situation. What can you say about that?
Well, I think probably 90% of our laws come from two of the Ten Commandments: thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal. I think that's probably true of just about any human society. You have to have a theory of property rights. You have to know what belongs to whom and who has the right to use it and control it. And you have to have a theory of how people deal with each other. And traditionally, religion has occupied kind of a lawgiver type of function. And so that's how, I mean, that's in my understanding is how most of our laws came about. And then, of course, in the Anglo-Saxon tradition, you had a very strong, in the English system in Britain, or England as it was called, you had a development of the law of contracts, which is very important. It emphasized the importance of freedom of choice and the right of free association. And the contract is, by definition, an agreement between two or more contracting parties based on a lawful goal and the element of mutual assent. That is to say, the parties all agreed to the contract. And the great evil of the civil rights laws is that it destroyed the element of mutual assent, and it gave one favored group the ability to force another disfavored group into an unwilling association. You know, if you own an apartment building and you don't want to rent to non-whites, the civil rights laws gave the non-white person the legal ability to force an unwilling white person into a contract. And it was really an attack on the traditional law of contracts. You don't hear that talked about very much.
Mm-hmm.
Tell you something that's very interesting. In the aftermath of the Civil War, the first Civil Rights Act was called the Civil Rights Act of 1866. And it was to deal with the problem of emancipated slaves. And it didn't abolish racial discrimination. It didn't say anything about racial discrimination at all. What it did say is that all persons in the United States will have the same rights to make and enforce contracts and to give evidence in court and to own and convey real property as enjoyed by white citizens. It was an attempt to legitimize these people and to vest them with the same contractual rights that white citizens had. And Justice Byron White dealt with that issue, and he said at that stage in history, white people didn't have the ability to contract with unwilling people. A contract, by definition, was an agreement between willing people.
Mm-hmm.
So the first attempt to give blacks social justice and equality was not to give them this lever against white people, but simply to give them the same rights of contract that white people had,
well,
so that everybody knew what the rules were.
Well, basically, where I was going with that was that we have all of these different civil rights laws, and going all the way back to the Civil War with the abolitionists and up to the Civil Rights Movement up till today, for the most part, a lot of the leading elements of these struggles have been people doing what they thought their God commanded them to do, which is basically to treat everybody as the same, equally. And now, of course, you look at the Torah, that isn't the case. People aren't treated equally. They're the chosen ones, and then they're the other people. But it seems that the people that have pushed through all of this awful legislation have been able to fleece everybody by making it seem like it's an order from up high, that this authority to take away the freedom of one people and to give their property to another is God's commandment. That this, whether it's whites, Jews, or whoever, Muslims enslaving other races, or if it's what's going on today, it's all seemingly coming from a very a similar source. And you mentioned that there are the lawgivers who are the religious figures. Of course, there's Moses. Jesus was another lawgiver. Going back, you have Hammurabi, or Hammurabi, Solon, Draco, Noah. They have brought in the Noahide laws in the 90s with George H.W. Bush. And there are all these other different examples. And you have figures like Martin Luther King, who is seen as almost a prophet from God, coming down to earth to bring about social justice. So I think people need to really understand that laws should not be dictated to us through various people saying that they come in the name of Yahweh or Allah or whoever else just because they said so. Once upon a time, our laws were based upon reason. They were based upon proper communal arrangements, not because some figure in the sky told some person, here's what I want you to do. And you mentioned that thou shalt not kill and thou shalt not steal, or two of the commandments brought down from Moses. But these were not unique commandments to Moses. This was just the way most people lived. It seems very interesting that the Ten Commandments and the Noahide laws were even necessary. Most people seem to just understand this in much of Europe. But I guess the people of the desert region needed some stronger guidance. Real quickly here, I just wanted to mention that although the Ten Commandments can be seen outside of certain courtrooms, although Moses is featured as one of the people on the back of the Supreme Court building, and although we now have money that is printed with In God We Trust, and people swear oaths in court, so help me God, that it has not always been this way. And currently some of these things, such as so help me God, are often optional because there actually is a law on the books that prohibits, let me see exactly what this says here. Government is prohibited. They have no power to compel people to take part in religious rituals. And if you actually look at the Constitution itself, the only time that religion is mentioned is to say that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, and also no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. But de facto, we currently do have the religious test that is required of people seeking office, which is that they must be at least some Christian denomination if they're seeking a high office. For the most part, there are people who have gained offices in certain places, and now they're Muslims and Buddhists and all sorts of people. But when you look at the founding of America, you look at the architecture of America, they were really drawing much of their inspiration. We are mentioning the Anglo-Saxons, but also going back to Rome and Greece. Of course, Rome had a deity, a pagan deity named Justitia, if I'm probably not saying that correctly, who was the Lady Justice. Often you'll see her featured in courtrooms outside of them. She represented a fair and equal administration of the law without corruption, avarice, prejudice, or favor. She was a goddess of divine justice, and she would usually be holding balanced scales and a sword, and sometimes wearing a blindfold. The ancient Greeks had Themis, and even just our words for government, although democracy doesn't appear in the Constitution, that's a Greek form of government, and although we are not currently really a republic, that is a Roman form of government. And basically, the reason I'm getting to all of this is because I really do see a push to impose a kind of theocracy upon the American people when, for the most part, most Americans were fleeing theocracies, were fleeing tyranny imposed by the church and by the governments who were completely in bed with each other.
What group of people do you see? I mean, what's the theology that's the basis of this theocracy?
Well, I think it is Judeo-Christian, just as is said, and also it seems like Sharia law is being enabled in certain areas of the Western world. I have just have a minute clip here from John McCain talking about why we need to accept all of these illegal immigrants. And we'll be back in just 1 minute here. I think this is
why didn't the army go down there and stop them? Because the only thing that stops them, I'm afraid to say, and it's too damn bad, but is a gun.
The border is 2,000 miles long, sir. I don't know how many troops and army people you think would have been required. I don't know how many you think would be required, but I'll give you expert information that shows you that probably maybe you're talking about 2 million soldiers.
Cut off their welfare and all their stuff and they'll go back.
The overwhelming majority of them are not going welfare. There are people who have been here illegally for 50 years or 40 years. Am I then telling them to become guest workers? No, you can't do that. Why can't you do that? Because we're a Judeo-Christian principled nation. That's why you can't do that.
You said build a dang fence. Where's the fence?
In case you missed it, I showed you it's not a fence, it's a banana. We've put up a banana with about $600 million worth of appropriations we have. You've had enough time, pal.
So whether or not John McCain is actually representing most Judeo-Christians in the United States is up for debate. Probably he's not. But it does seem that churches have played a very large role in pushing forth this idea that we need to embrace our brothers across the border, and that it is evil and racist to go against this. And I just think that when you're dealing with a discussion of legal issues, If you're not bringing in religion at all, you'd be omitting a very important part. Because as I already mentioned, in most courts now, people do swear to God that the testimony that they're giving is true. So it definitely plays a part, the religious mindset in our legal affairs. And as I also mentioned, the Noahide laws were pretty much put into effect in the early 90s by George Herbert Walker Bush. And these are 7 laws that I did a whole show on this, and it relates to different Jewish interest groups. Rebbe Schneerson, who is basically seen as the Messiah of not just Chabad Lubavitch, but some of the more elite elements, such as Bibi Netanyahu and others. So it's just a little bit worrisome to me to see religious fanatics of any sort taking control of the legal system.
Well, I don't see the legal system being taken over by religious fanatics. I think that the term Judeo-Christian, is we just heard it used by John McCain, is being used very dishonestly. I'm not aware that there's anything in the New Testament that requires people to join a suicide pact and allow themselves to be conquered and stripped of their lives and their property by a conquering nation. So a lot of this stuff is just rhetoric that is used to deceive people. I said in the beginning that The shakers and movers behind the so-called civil rights movement and many of the changes that have occurred in this country, even during the Civil War, did so by through the use of dishonest language. You know, the Brown versus the Board of Education. Now, that there is no act that is so evil as Brown versus the Board of Education, yet which parades behind a mask of rhetoric that talks about equality and social justice and humanity and all these wonderful bromides. The term Judeo-Christianity is a complete contradiction in terms, as is well known by anybody who knows very much about theology. but it's used by John McCain, I don't believe is emblematic of a theocracy. It's emblematic of a demagogue who is using a religious argument to influence people when he hasn't got a rational argument to use in its place.
Fair enough.
That's my assessment of that.
Well, that's what I think oftentimes happens with these preachers of false doctrines, is that they go out there, and because they can't put together a rational argument for why something should be this way or that, they say, because God said so, because this is what God wants us to do. And people are going to be interpreting God's word in so many different ways, and all sorts of different people are going to claim to speak for divine justice. But as you're saying, most of them are just there to mislead the flocks, as it were.
Well, where does God call for the extermination of white people? Where does Jesus ever call for the extermination of any particular group? I've never heard that.
Well, there is the line in the Bible about how in Jesus there is no Jew or Gentile, no Greek, no man or woman. So that has been interpreted by some people to say that we're all one. It doesn't matter.
That's Christian universalism. That doesn't really mandate the extermination of any group. Yet all of these so-called Judeo-Christians are proceeding in that direction. They're actually advocating a theory of international relations and a theory of civil rights. Look, all of this civil rights stuff really translates into white people being relegated to the level of servitude. Illegal aliens come here, they have all these rights. They have a right to free health care, free education, free food stamps, so on and so forth. Who pays for that? Working white people pay for that. If I have the right to the product of your labor, you are reduced to the level of servitude, and I'm elevated to a higher class as a conqueror or as a superior person. It's just that simple. You know, in Brown versus the Board of Education, they invented a brand new constitutional right that said blacks have a right to force white children to sit in a classroom next to them. That is morally and philosophically indistinguishable from the theory of slavery, that a white plantation owner had a right to force a black person to work on his plantation, separate and apart from the personal preferences of the black person who was there. And when black children ran away from the slave owners under slavery, they were hunted down with packs of dogs. Today, when white parents and white children run away, they're hunted down with packs of lawyers. That's the only difference.
Yeah. Well, Don, this does seem to go back to the Bible again with the enslavement of black people, because the justification that was given by at least some people was that this is just the curse of Ham, one of Noah's sons, Noah's son who saw him naked, I think. So then he was cursed to be enslaved to the peoples of the earth, and his skin was darkened. I honestly don't know the tale, right now. But
white slave traders did not go and bring millions of blacks from Africa because of the curse of Ham. They went there because they could make them work on plantations, and it was fabulously wealthy. That's the real beat. I mean, the rest of it is just something that's stuck on for window dressing. The reason this evil was committed, as the source of so much evil, is the source of being able to steal the wealth of other people. Whether it's white people whose wealth is being stolen today, or it was black people whose labor was being stolen, 200 years ago. I don't think, I never owned slaves, and neither did any other living white person, but I was astonished to find out that there are blacks in Africa today who do own slaves and who openly engage in the slave trade.
Yes.
And where's the indignation about that?
No, there are estimated to be up to 200 million slaves in the world today, but we're just going to keep seeing movies like Amistad, Django Unchained, 12 Years a Slave, and the rest. That just will focus on this one part of American history, instill a guilt complex in white people, and make the black people even more violent and more incited to go out and commit crimes against their white neighbors. That's what's been happening since Django Unchained came out, and Jamie Foxx, who went on Saturday Night Live and said, he kills all the white people in the movie. How great is that? And then it's reinforced with laughter and applause. The black people watching this movie, they're going out there and they're committing crimes. They're playing the knockout game. They call it a game. If white people were to do it, it wouldn't be called a game. It would be called attempted murder. It'd be called assault. It'd be called a hate crime. Yeah. But with blacks, it's called a game. Oh, they're just playing. They're playing with you, white man. It's or white woman or grandmother. It's disgusting that the mass media can get away with inciting anti-white violence and nothing's done about it.
Where does the mass media draw its power? It draws the power from white people whose consumer dollars fund the sponsors. How did O.J. Simpson become a millionaire? He became a millionaire because white sports fans paid for the people who sponsored him and people whose advertisements he appeared in. White people have the ability to cut off the money spigot to the enemies of white existence. And that more and more white people have got to realize this, that we have got to stop funding the people who hate us and want us dead. I haven't been in a movie theater in 10 years, and I will never go back to a movie theater for that reason. And other white people have got to start thinking the same way. You've got to stop funding professional athletics. You've got to stop funding Hebrewwood, also known as Hollywood. You've just got to stop giving these people your money, and you've got to start organizing, and you've got to resolve that white people have a right to exist and that we are not going to go down without a fight.
Well said. We have a caller here. Let's try bringing them on. Hello, caller. Who is this?
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air. Hello? I can barely hear you. You're not coming through well at all. Okay, sounding a little bit better. Hello?
Yeah.
Yes. Do you have a question or a comment for Attorney Don Advo?
I have kind of a question. It seems like, I mean, what he's saying is that the law, as it's written now, is not in our interest. But it kind of seems like what he's saying is the way the law was written was in our interest. But, I mean, I don't know. It doesn't really make any sense. I mean, the laws that allowed slavery were never in our interest. I mean, they were directly opposed to our interest. They were from the top. They were a capitalist, you know, purely a capitalist enterprise.
Well, they made it harder for white people in America to be able to work on any plantations, that's for sure. They made it awful for the white people who were then basically forced into a position lower than the black people after the Civil War, Reconstruction era, where anybody who participated in the Civil War was basically – their rights were completely stripped from them, and this is why the Ku Klux Klan, the first version of it, was needed, was to restore law and order, because none existed. And although slavery did not really work out for us well at the time, a lot of our legal system does seem to have been put in place to buy the founding stock of this country to benefit their offspring. Don, what do you think about that?
I do not approve of slavery and have never approved of laws that justified slavery. I frankly didn't understand the comment from the caller. Perhaps he could clarify his question, because I really didn't understand where he was going with that.
Yes, could you have a more focused question for us, please?
Well, I mean, it just kind of seems like, it's kind of like it just seems like you're saying that the laws as they exist today are, you know, not in our interest. We need to change them. They're not, you know, however you want to put it.
Are you asking, were they ever in our interests? Is that what you're getting at?
They were never really in our interest. The whole thing.
All right. Well,
the problem.
Thanks for the question / comment there. Do you have anything else you'd like to add to that, Don?
Well, I don't know what he means. They were never in our interest. I think they were certainly more in our interest before we were relegated to the level the subordinate level of a debtor race. I mean, the whole premise of the civil rights laws and the doctrine of Martin Luther King is that America, that is to say white America, owes a tremendous debt to black people. And there is no constitutional basis, no basis in Anglo-Saxon law or any other law that I am aware of that supports the concept of intergenerational racial indebtedness. I mean, you know, the fact that your great-great-grandfather may have rustled cattle off my great-great-grandfather's farm doesn't mean that you owe me $100,000, okay? What went on between those two individuals 150 years ago, as far as I'm concerned, died with them. There's no basis for me to impose liability on you, and there is no basis for blacks who never were slaves to plunder the wealth of white people who never owned slaves. And the whole premise of this whole civil rights fraud is that white people should be relegated to servitude to blacks and now Mexicans and now the transgender and the gays and all these other goofball minorities, is that we're rendered a subordinate to all these people. We can't say no to anybody. Let me give you an example. And where I live in metropolitan Los Angeles, there's a newspaper called the Sentinel. It's the oldest black newspaper in Los Angeles County. All the writers are black. All the pictures are black people. They have advertisements in there from black professionals to advertise for black people. If I started a white law firm and I advertised in a white newspaper for white clients, I would be crucified by the California State Bar and the Civil Rights Division. This is an example how every other race can engage in racial partisanship. They can have their own racial businesses. They can have an all-black newspaper. An all-white newspaper would never be permitted to exist. But every other group can organize except us. And we are getting our brains beaten out for that reason. We are relegated to the level of a subordinate race. We've been stripped of rights that are exercised by other people. It's no more complicated than that. And the civil rights laws have stripped us of our right to organize, to advocate our own interests. And until and unless we deal with that fact, we're not going to go anywhere, because we're going to be defending ourselves as isolated individuals against enemies that are very well organized and very well funded. It's like a group of individuals pulled off the street and given football uniforms and sent out to play against an organized team. We're going to get wiped out.
Yeah, well said. Let's go to another caller here. This one seems to be calling from Skype, perhaps. Hello, caller. Who is this?
Hello?
Yes. Welcome to the show. Do you have a question or comment?
I just have something on my mind. I was wondering about
comment.
This. This might be off topic, but these people who say they don't see color, they don't care what color you are, white, brown, blue, green, orange, like, I always wonder, where do they come up with, like, blue, green, orange, and all these rainbow colors? Do you have any answer for that?
Okay, well, I guess it turned into a question. I'm not sure if I really understood that question. Don, do you have a response for that?
I didn't really understand the question either. I guess if you have people who make those statements, if you want to know where they got their beliefs, you'd have to ask them. I don't have any answer to that.
Yeah, well, when you see a rainbow nation, it's likely going to mean it's very, very dark. There aren't going to be a whole lot of colors. It's like South Africa, and white is not included in that rainbow. That's the best answer I can give the caller. We got another one here. Hello, caller, you're on the air. Who is this?
757.
Yeah, that's you. I was going to read out your area code in case you didn't want people to know where you're from, but yes, 757. Who is this?
Hey, it's Celtic Pride. What's going on, Kyle?
Well, just having a fascinating conversation here with Attorney Don Advil. Do you have any questions or comments that you'd like to add to this discussion?
Yes, sir. I got a question. I talk to a lot of black people at work, and I always break them down a different way. But when I make the point of saying that, you know, they're getting free advantages, and how does it feel to feel like you've accomplished something but to be given a head start against other races? I mean, does that make you feel like your accomplishment is worth less? And to kind of spin off that comment, do you think we could ever repeal the Civil Rights Act, the affirmative action stuff, through federal legislation?
Well, I don't know if you heard earlier in the show, KP, but there is the Advil Amendment, which would make it so that you wouldn't have to repeal all the civil rights legislations, you'd basically just nullify them. Don, you want to maybe correct me if I'm wrong and also answer the first part of this question there?
No, you're absolutely right. The operation of that amendment, if it was ever ratified, would pretty much wipe out these laws without the need to appeal, to repeal each and every one. That would be an extraordinary task. But I didn't understand the first part of his comment.
Could you restate it, please, Celtic Pride?
Oh, really, really, when I have interactions with black people, which I'm forced to where I work, when I'm kind of spitting my political theories to them, when we get to race or whatever, I make it known that any accomplished black man is getting a head start against white man, or any non-white is getting a head start against white man through affirmative action, you know, racial quotas and government jobs, all the standards that are lower throughout the schools for blacks to get in. You know, I make it known that that's happened. I show them requirements. I mean, I've proved it to them, because sometimes they don't believe me. I say, now, how does that make you feel to know you're being catered to like a child to even keep up with us?
What do they say?
I say, it would be... I've done this numerous times, and they don't like it. They say affirmative action is bullshit. They actually feel like they don't want it, because they don't want the advantage, because they feel inside they're more dominant than us anyway. So for them to feel like they're getting an advantage, it demoralizes them. But see, they don't control the affirmative action. The Jews do, and they don't know that. So when I tell them about the Jewish problem and that they're controlling you and using you like a little monkey, it pisses them off.
Yeah, I don't know that I would talk that way at my job. Not a good idea to piss people off at your job. But I guess that's your individual call.
I'm in the military, so it's a different type of environment.
Oh, okay. So, I mean, I hope none of these people are behind you with loaded rifles when you're out in the field.
On a ship, I would think, correct?
Yep.
Yeah,
so, okay.
So might be a little bit different of environment. From what I can understand, the Navy is perhaps the most pro-white of the different military branches, but yeah, I'm not sure about that.
I heard it was the Air Force, but I don't have any personal experience to base that on. So, but if you're in the Navy and you serve with these people and you may have to depend on their good graces to save your life, maybe you should... not be antagonizing them too much. I don't know.
You don't antagonize them. You just approach them at a different angle. You don't approach them like you hate them. You don't approach them like that. You try to let them know that Jews are using them. You try to let them know that Martin Luther King is a fake and a fraud. And they start figuring that stuff out. They're like, damn. So you're trying to use the black people against the Jews. You're using them. You're manipulating them in your favor. You see what I'm saying?
Well, I think bringing up facts like the NAACP was founded and led by Jews for much of its existence is a good one. You could even quote Donald Sterling, also known as Donald Tokowitz, the Clippers owner, the Clippers owner, who said that over in Israel they treat blacks like dogs. You can show them that the reason that they're at the tops of organizations like the NAACP, the reason they were doing this was not to actually help the blacks, but to destroy white people. And that destroying white people is not in the best interest of the blacks. Case in point, Detroit.
I've made those points, and because obviously basketball is such a huge deal to black people, and there's two of them I work with. I said, you know, his last name is Tokowitz. He's a Jew. Just like the commissioner is, just like commissioner of all major sports until Goodell got in the NFL. Because that's the only way you can relate to people. You gotta be able to relate to them. And then you say, well, I was like, I estimate over 60% of the NBA's basketball teams are owners or Jews.
It's more than that.
I think that's accurate.
It might be more than that. Most people, whites included, look at people on the television, they look at the ownerships of these companies, and they don't really draw the distinction between white people and Jews, and they just see this as white dominance over industries. It's part of the white male establishment. So I think it is important that, I think it's important that we make that distinction and show that how, 2% of the United States population owns a disproportionate amount of, let's call it privilege. There's a certain privilege that comes with being part of the chosen tribe. And as much of a hand up that these minority groups will get, and as much as white people will get kicked down, none of these other groups will get as much privilege as these chosen ones. So I do think that that's a good point you bring up there. KP, I've got some other callers on the line, so thanks for calling in.
All right, you guys take it easy. I'll be listening.
All right, thanks. Take care. We've got, I believe this is Tom Bowie from La Plata, Maryland.
Yeah, La Plata, Maryland. Yes, sir.
Oh, La Plata. That's right. Welcome.
How much of the law is based upon exact interpretation, and how much of the anti-white law is based on kind of a preferential interpretation, would you estimate?
It's a little hard to answer your question. Virtually all of civil rights laws are interpreted against white people, even though they are nominally race neutral on their face. But the overwhelming majority of most laws are pretty much race neutral. I mean, you got the vehicle code and the health and safety code and the penal code and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it's pretty much race neutral. You don't have, one set of sentencing guidelines for white people and another set for black people ordinarily, and you have the same laws essentially applying to people. But, I mean, the real offensive laws are the civil rights laws. They were designed to target white people and strip white people of various kinds of civil rights. So that's really, I hope that answers your question.
Well, how did white people go along with this at the time? I offered the explanation that most white people weren't actually too affected by them at the time. It's just that years later they started to really kick in, and white was no longer working.
And let's talk about Brown versus the Board of Education, which in my view is probably among the most evil. I think most people went along with it because there was a kind of a bias against Southern white people, and many of these civil rights laws were seen by whites that were outside the South as a means of punishing white Southerners. There's a tremendous bias against the South that goes back to the Civil War, and in the post-Civil War years, there was tremendous hatred and bias against white Southerners. It was very strange because even during the Civil War, a lot of the northern states that were so-called free states had very, very powerful anti-black laws called black codes. I mean, in Illinois, the state of Illinois, Lincoln's nominally his home state, they had very powerful anti-black laws. It was against the law for free blacks to come into Illinois and settle there. It was tremendous racism. So it seems very strange that, white people in Illinois and in Indiana, which also had very strong anti-black laws, would volunteer to go free black slaves so that they can surge north into your state and destroy your communities and dumb down your schools. And the Civil War made no sense because most white people in the north really didn't have a financial or advantage to be gained from freeing the slaves, which only would have been more of them would come to the north. So you got to wonder what the hell people were even thinking. A lot of them, of course, were opposed to the war, and Lincoln had to declare martial law, shut down a bunch of newspapers, and put a lot of people in jail who were opposed to the war. So the Civil War, supposedly fought in the name of democracy, was actually achieved in large measure because of very anti-democratic measures that were implemented, first of all, in the North, and second of all, in the South when it was occupied. So you had the transformation of this country from a country based on consent of the governed to conquest of the governed, both in the North and in the Southern states. So the whole thing is a very, very puzzling conundrum.
Tom, do you have anything else you'd like to ask or add?
Yes, sir. One final question. As whites begin to express their dissatisfaction and assert themselves, Do you see the way the law is interpreted swinging more towards our favor, perhaps, or perhaps back to at least neutral?
Well, I think the courts follow the ballot box. Ultimately, the courts are going to go along with political pressure. I think if white people show more political pressure, more political awareness, we're going to get a better shake in the courts. Courts are tremendously influenced by political pressure. I mean, they deny that they do, and they're supposedly all independent and all that. But, I mean, you're talking about rank-and-file courts where you get hauled in on a traffic ticket, or are you talking about the Supreme Court where really major issues are decided? I think that white people are going to continue to be crapped on until and unless they start to organize and very, very aggressively advocate white racial interests. That's my answer.
All right.
Both excellent answers. I thank you much, sir.
Well, thank you.
Have a good night, Tom. All right, we have another caller on the line here. Looks like it will be the last caller of the show. I have a couple more questions to get through, but we will be going into the overtime of the streaming here, if that's all right with you, Don. Just
sure.
We can go a little bit longer to wrap up here. So we'll go to the caller. Hello, caller. You're on the air. Who is this?
Yeah, can you hear me okay?
Yes, you're coming through just fine.
Yeah, I had a couple quick questions for the lawyer on the show. The first is, have you ever heard of the case of Jerome Daly?
No.
Jerome Daly, no. All right, next question.
Okay, the next question is there a legal theory under which people could sue to get their voice out there, is there some legal theory that they can sue to say that it's not a free media because it's owned by corporations that are more loyal to outsiders than to their own country?
The short answer is no. Can you challenge the corporate media on the grounds that you don't have a voice in it? And the answer is no, you really can't. You have other media such as this podcast that you can express your own voice on. You can raise your own voice. Get the banner and stand out on the street corner with a bunch of your friends and present your views to your neighbors and the people driving by. Don't let corporate-owned media be an excuse to remain silent.
Well,
yeah,
then perhaps go ahead, caller.
I've never stated
his name.
I just wanted to say, is that fair? Is that justice that they can reach 300 million people with their broadcast, and we can reach 300?
Well, no, I guess it's not fair, but you know, you do what you can with what you have.
And the other thing would just be just civil rights in general, like you say, where these white people are at these rallies, and that they're the ones that are blamed and ticketed. Can't they sue for civil rights violations for that?
In theory, yes. In theory, yes.
Won't listen to them, or?
Well, it costs a lot of money to file lawsuits, for one thing. You have to have be able to sustain it financially, and yeah, there have been civil rights lawsuits filed against some of these minority groups that have attacked people at rallies. That has happened, but it's a very difficult thing to do. It's very expensive to fund it. See, we have no organizations to help us with that, and all the other races do.
I guess
that's how asymmetrical it is.
It really does come down to how well you're organized. I remember studying sociology, and I remember saying that's the problem with majorities, is that they don't have they have less of an ability to organize themselves, large majorities. But
well, we're becoming a minority, so maybe it will happen.
Yeah. And I just wanted to throw in there, if you guys never heard. Kyle, have you ever heard of Jerome Daly?
No, I have not. Can you give us just a very brief summary and perhaps give people some direction where they can read more about it?
Yeah, it was a legal case in which it was about contract law, and all contracts have three elements: offer, acceptance, and valuable consideration. And basically what happened was, it was a test case. he allowed his house to be foreclosed upon, and then he took him to court, and he said that the contract wasn't valid because they repossessed his house for taking a paper, for not paying him back a paper entity which has no money, a paper entity which has no value. And he won the case, and he came up dead later on. Yeah, I just wanted to throw that out there for everyone to maybe get a look at. And the other thing was, I called in on the show when I was talking to Dana. I made a mistake. I said Diocletian is the one who made it illegal to persecute Christians. It was really, I should have said Constantine. So I just wanted to correct myself. But that's all I had, Kyle. I know you have other callers. So I can just I can be muted and listen.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling in and asking some good questions there. Now, Don, is there actually some legal recourse for us in this fight against white genocide? Because I'm fairly certain that even though I don't know law all that well, I could write a fairly compelling case, and already have written some different articles about this, proving that what is taking place is, in fact, genocide, by definition, of white people. Why can't we bring this to court and prove this? Of course, because we don't have the financing and power as our opponents, but is there some way that we can really bring down the power of law upon the people who seek the destruction of the white race?
The short answer is no, you can't. The problem you've got there is there's a lot of problems. First of all, genocide, I don't think it's an American concept. It's some kind of United Nations concept.
Right, yes.
It kind of gets invoked when they want to invoke victor's justice. It only gets invoked against people who lose wars. It doesn't get invoked against people who win wars, however genocidally they may have waged those wars. The second thing is that in America you have something called the separation of powers. And most of the things, you have the executive branch, the legislative branch, consisting of the two houses of Congress, and the judicial branch. And you know, you're going to ask the judicial branch that invented constitutional rights out of thin air, such as in Brown versus the Board of Education and others, to vindicate the rights of white, to vindicate the rights of white people, whom this same court has done so much to destroy. I don't think the courts are ever going to do that. It would be very strange. I mean, what would be the relief that you would be asking for? To invalidate a bunch of civil rights laws? To invalidate prior court holdings? It's difficult to imagine how you could frame a lawsuit that would really deal with that issue. It's very difficult because it's a labyrinth of very different social policies that have been brought to bear against us. You've got legislative policies such as the Civil Rights Act of 64 and all these voting rights acts and all these other things. Then you've got the judicially created laws and doctrines such as Brown versus the Board of Education. So it would be very difficult to reduce that to a single lawsuit. And you're talking about the cumulative efforts of a lot of different groups and a lot of different branches. So who would even be the defendants in such a lawsuit as that? It's not a judicial thing. It's a thing that's got to be solved legislatively and politically. It's a political fight, not a judicial fight.
Okay. Well,
there may be judicial aspects of it, but basically it's a political fight. Look, enough white people have got to take seriously the issue of white survival for anything to work. And we're always looking for some shortcut. We're always looking for something like that, like, you know, the 28th Amendment. Got no chance of ever being adopted, but it does focus the attention on the relationship between the right of freedom of association and the new servitude that is being foisted on white people. And you got to open some windows somehow.
Well, there's a question in the chat here from Nick Sparrow from Circus Maximus. He asked, what effect the 14th Amendment had on white people?
It's been devastating. It's been a devastating expansion of congressional power and even judicial power. Brown versus the Board of Education, which vested black people with property rights and white children, was designed based on the 14th, was decided based on the 14th Amendment. I mean, how bizarre is that? How bizarre is that, that an amendment which guarantees equal protection of the law allows one race to bring captive children from another race and force them into a classroom with them? It's Orwellian. It's totally bizarre. And I've never heard any other commentator properly identify the effect of Brown versus the Board of Education. What Brown said was, I'll summarize the issue. It says, we come to the question presented, does segregation of children in public schools solely on the basis of race, even though physical facilities and other tangible factors may be equal, deprive the children of the minority group of equal educational opportunities? We believe it does. So they've defined the physical presence of white children as an educational opportunity. Well, that's very interesting. Didn't the slave owners in the Old South define the existence of black slaves as an economic opportunity? You see what you've done here is, under the old system of slavery, white people were vested in possessory rights in black people. Under the new slavery, black people are vested in the possessory rights of captive white children. They are morally indistinguishable.
And captive white taxpayers.
Captive white taxpayers. And when the captive white taxpayers run away, they are hunted down with packs of lawyers. That's the only difference between the old slavery and the new slavery. Very superficial differences, but they're only superficial. Fundamentally, the new slavery is morally indistinguishable from the old slavery. It results in a targeted race of people being subjected to special persecution and special treatment. They're hunted down when they run away, and they're looted when they're caught. And I know it's a hard concept to understand first, but when you think about it, it becomes increasingly clear. Hello?
I have a question from – yes, can you hear me?
I can hear you now. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, great. Yeah, it sounded like you're breaking up just a little bit there. So we'll try to wrap this up very shortly here. I just have another question. This one comes from another host on the network who asks whether or not there is any kind of legal action that can be taken against internet trolls, people who harass those of us who are pro-white, and also make threats against us. Is there some kind of legal avenue that we should take to protect ourselves and to potentially initiate prosecution against the people who make life such a hell for those of us who are pro-white online?
Well, I mean, if all they're doing is making threats on the line, maybe they can be prosecuted. There are a whole lot of laws about that. I'm not really an expert on that and don't know much about it. I suspect as a practical matter, there's not much you can do.
Yeah,
but I mean, if they get physical or do something like that, then, of course, you can take legal action against them. But if some guy emails you an email that says, you know, I'm going to beat your brains out or something like that, I mean, if you can track him down, maybe there can be a criminal prosecution. You could certainly it could certainly be the basis of an action for a restraining order. The problem is that the courts are not very friendly to us, and there's really not much you can do. I mean, I was subjected to threats of violence and all kinds of crap, and I saw it was really pretty futile. The thing is that most people who threaten you aren't going to really do very much. The thing that most really scared me were the people who didn't make threats but had the capability to do great harm. So I know that's not very comforting to you, but that's kind of the reality. Sorry I couldn't give you more encouragement than that.
No, that's quite all right. It makes sense. It definitely that's what I've intuitively known for quite some time now, and that's why I haven't really pursued any kind of legal action against the people who have made threats against me and against others. What do you think about the Declaration of Independence? Now, this was not law that was put in place, but it basically served to sever the people of America, the colonists, from the laws of Great Britain and the different taxes that they opposed. And, of course, this has the famous line in there, when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God, entitle them. A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to separation. Do you think that that is what is needed yet again? Do we need to just say, we are separating from you and the mess that you have created, and we are starting anew? Or do we basically need to stay within this system and try to take control of it and to reform it?
Well, the short answer is, if the Southern, the Confederate States of America could not prevail in a war for their independence, I don't think individual white people today are going to have much of a choice. I think we have to organize ourselves as best we can. I think America is going to break up. I do not think America is very long for this world in its present configuration. And I think when it breaks up, it's going to be a pretty nasty, ugly thing in a lot of places. The main thing is that people have to prepare for that to happen. I don't think productive thing. No, I don't think any kind of violent revolution is really going to work. I think the system is going to collapse under the weight of its own contradictions. And what we have to do in the meantime is get prepared and get organized and have a kind of a blueprint of what our society is going to be and what it's going to be like. And well, that's where I think things like the 28th Amendment may come in, because you're going to see regions forming their own governments and forming their own compacts and their own new constitutions. And we need something like the 28th Amendment to be part of that.
If you had your way, how would you best define the type of government you would like to see in the future? Democracy, a republic, any of these other anarcho-capitalist, minarchist, national socialist? What kind of government do you think would best suit the American people, the white American people? Or any other people around the world.
Well, I'm glad you qualified that, the white American people. I think it's very problematic. I like the Constitutional Republic. I think that has served white people very, very well. And when we were essentially an all-white nation and we shared many common cultural characteristics, it worked extremely well. People kind of self-organized themselves. White people don't need a lot of authoritarianism. As has been shown by the United States, our early formative years were years that were characterized by great productivity, great invention, great efforts by people to uplift themselves and ennoble themselves. We didn't need a huge welfare state, and we certainly didn't need a surveillance state. I think in the meantime, there's going to be a lot of, when the breakup comes, there's going to be a need for some authoritarianism, though. I think you're going to see a need for somebody, martial law, and there's not going to be very much time to vote on a lot of things. Some people are going to have to seize the moment and take action. And I think a lot of it is going to be done by consensus rather than by having a kind of a formal election that's going to be people organizing themselves. And I think one thing we saw in the Rodney King riots here in 92 is that in those areas, the white areas, there was no rioting and no looting. It all occurred in other areas. White people tend to be very self-regulating for the most part. We don't need a lot of law and order. We do need laws. We do need means of resolving disputes in the courts, but we don't need somebody there watching us every minute and telling us what we can or can't do. We do a pretty good job of governing ourselves. That's my answer.
Well, here's a quick quotation from James Madison. Democracies have ever been spectacles of turbulence and conflict, have ever been found incompatible with personal security or the rights of property, and have in general been as short in their lives as they have been violent in their deaths. So it seems a lot of the founding fathers did not really think of democracies in a positive light. And a constitutional republic, I think, would definitely serve our people much better than what we have right now. And I don't even want to get into trying to define what it is exactly that we have right now, this monstrosity. But Don, I just wanted to wrap up this show and say thank you so much for being my guest tonight. It was a fascinating conversation, and I really enjoy getting your input. And I thought it was an actually stimulating conversation for the audience as well, to bring these kinds of issues to the forefront so that we can take a look at this problem of white genocide from the legal lens and try to understand it so that we might be able to better our situation moving forward. Do you have any final thoughts you'd like to add, any concluding statements?
Yeah, I have a message to white people. Organize or die. It's that simple.
It kind of reminds me of a revolutionary flag. It had a snake that was severed into multiple pieces on it, and it said, join or die. So
I think that's basically the message. I mean, it doesn't matter the form of government. We can talk about that for hours, and you can get endlessly involved in things like that, but it's just going to boil down to organize or die. White people can sort things out among ourselves if we have our own communities, and we're not encumbered by all these non-white parasites that are destroying our lifeblood.
Yes. Well, Don, please tell the audience one more time how they can hear you on Stormfront Radio.
Just go to Stormfront on the Internet and click on it. There is an Internet. There is a phone number you can dial and you can listen to on your cell phone. Hang on just a second here, and I can tell you what the number is. It's 712. 712-432-7855. If you dial that number, you can listen on your cell phone, or you can listen online live, or you can listen to the archived shows.
All right, fantastic. Thank you again so much for appearing on the program, and hopefully we'll talk again soon. Stay in touch.
Looking forward to it. Thanks again. Bye.
Bye. All right, folks, thank you so much for listening out there. Please check out all the other great hosts at renegadebroadcasting.com. And I want to thank everybody out there who has helped to support the network and to support me personally and this program. Really, I do appreciate it. You guys mean a whole lot to me. And until next week, I bid you all adieu. And this song I will play will probably be the first and last time I play Styx on Renegade Broadcasting, but the title of the song is Renegade, so it is quite fitting and deals with the topic at hand tonight. Again, thank you. Be well, everyone.
Oh, mama, I'm in fear for my life from the long arm of the law. Lawman is putting an end to my running, and I'm so far from my home.
Oh, mama, I can hear you a-crying, you're so scared and all alone. Hangman is coming down from the gallows, and I don't have very long.